Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, when I go to Carver, I always like to always like to walk by Surplus Sids, and when I can, I like to stick my head in the door because there's always something interesting. For me, it's like a museum because Barry Keith, the owner of Surplus Sids, has got everything in that store, everything from old uniforms, combat boots, combat equipment, to costumes. And Barry Keith, thanks for coming to give me the inside scoop on how you run Surplus Sids.
Thanks for having me here.
Start out by telling me where'd you come from and how'd you get into this business?
Well, I was a native North Carolinian, born and raised in North Carolina. Attended the University of North Carolina, graduated in 78. And it probably the whole thing with the surplus business started at that time. There was another, well, I like to call him a legend in the surplus business. A lot of people that have been in Chapel Hill for a long, long time will remember who was here that had a surplus store by the name of Poor Richards. And
Where was that?
Well, Richard was all over the place. Richard should have been in show business. He needed a new opening every 6 weeks. He moved all. He started in Eastgate for about 1968, and then he moved all around and all over the place. And went, and I was a manager for him in the mid 70s.
How'd you work your way into that job?
One of the hobbies I had years ago in college and through high school or whatever, as strange as it is, I started collecting hats.
As a kid.
Not caps, not like baseball caps, but actual hats. Hats
like
of some kind of
derbies or
derbies or fedoras or military hats or flying aviator helmets and things like that. Richard had a lot of hats, and so I'd go down there and I'd trade with him and talk to him. And, you know, Richard would either get mad with me and throw me out the store, or either he'd sell me something, one of the two. And I guess just
this
by
is why you were
continuation.
In college.
Yes, in the mid years of college. And so I got to know him. He offered me a job. I worked for him. Richard showed me, I went with him several times out to Vegas where the big surplus shows were. Richard showed me what was all about the business.
But did you start out? You were just selling. You were just on the floor selling.
Yeah, just
and
selling
then,
for him.
Then
yeah.
He had he identified you as somebody who might be able to help him in the buying end of the business.
Well, Richard probably hired and fired me about three, four, or five times.
What do you mean?
He'd get mad with you and he'd fire you, you know, and he'd send me out the door.
Did he pay you anything?
Well, some, yeah.
Like $1 an hour or something like that.
I can't even remember what it was, but I mean, it was a decent, you know, decent whatever the going rate was at the time. And
Now you've got my curiosity up. He would take you to Las Vegas, and you just said matter-of-factly where the surplus shows are. Well, what are the surplus shows? We don't know anything about that.
Well, it's one or two times a year that a lot of dealers in dealing with surplus, the governments, military, or industrial markets that overbuy in excess. They have to dispose of that excess. Now, if you look at the military, there's an organization in the military called DRMO, Defense Reutilization Maintenance Organization. And that's how the military disposes of excess that it has. And you can go to bid in auctions that they have and bid on lots of items, and meaning lots of items at a particular grouping of items that they have. As a weird example of how it is, if it's let's say it's 200 camouflage jackets that you really want to get your hands on, inside that grouping there may be 8,000 quarts of motor oil. You might have four marine inboard motors and a huge grouping of kitchen equipment.
You
got to buy all of it at the same time to get exactly to what you want. So that tends to make surplus pretty eclectic when you get it back to the store. And then to continue what I was talking about the surplus show in Vegas, is there's a lot of larger dealers than like smaller dealers like myself that will go in and buy in mass.
So they'll buy it and then resell it to you rather than selling it.
Yeah, and so they become like
a
middleman.
So you go to Las Vegas to find out what's available?
Yeah.
How does that work?
It's called the ADS, Associated Surplus Dealer Shows. They have it there about twice a year, and sometimes they have it in another part of the country, but generally they like Vegas, a large convention format out there. And that's what Richard took me out and introduced me to. And he just took me around. He said, you buy this from these people. You go get this from these people over here. We'd go down further on into the show somewhere. And he'd introduce me to somewhere else. And I just made, for whatever reason, I don't know if you think long term and things, I just made a lot of notes about this is what you do, this is what you do, and form it, and then just kind of filed it away. And then after I graduated, I went on and did a lot of, well, strange and what I like to think adventurous things for a few years.
Like what?
Well, that's a long story there in itself, and probably more.
Is there any part of it that you'd be willing to share with us? Or is this a lost time that you...
Well, I'll call it... You ever heard of the story of the life and times of Judge Roy Bean? Yeah, you know, down in Vinegaroon County, Texas, where he says, you know, well, if it ain't the truth, it's the way it should have been. I mean, that's what...
Well, you could tell us the story. We couldn't check on you. I mean, you could...
Well, I better just leave it at that.
So 4 or 5 years out in doing things that you're not going to tell us about.
Well, about 3 or 4 years of doing that. And then had a little bit of money put aside and ended up buying a couple of restaurants down in South Carolina. And I did that for about 5 years.
And now, all right, now you got me curious because like just regular home cooking restaurants or high-end restaurants?
No, mid-range. Something akin to like a something that was akin to like an Applebee's today or whatever. It was a group out of Charlotte. What, you grew up in Charlotte, right?
Yeah.
You remember a restaurant down there called the White Horse?
Yeah.
The White Horse. That's what it was. That was the name of the restaurant. That's what I had. I had the White Horse.
So you had their sort of like a franchise for the White Horse.
Right.
What towns in South Carolina?
In Spartanburg. And
well, now that is a business that's so hard that you'd want to almost do anything.
I admire anybody that wants to stay in the restaurant business. I'm going to be honest with you. The restaurant business is somewhat like a jealous mistress. It just keeps you there for like all the time. It's like 90 hours a week, you know. I took one vacation in 5 years, and
you can't leave. I mean, because there's be something going wrong, or management of the food supply coming in, or some of it walking out the back door. What was that going to happen at the cash register?
Well, exactly.
The service.
Exactly.
It's a tough business.
You really have to stay on top of it.
Did you make any money at it?
I made really good money at it. I just never had time to spend any of it. That was what's going on. And. When I get that, I often say this about the restaurant business. I said, the two happiest days I had were the days I bought them and the days I sold them. And everything.
Maybe the day you sold it was even happier than the day you bought it.
Quite. But restaurants are a tough go. I admire anybody that wants to stay in the restaurant business. I had an uncle that's in and out of the restaurant business, and one of the greatest quotes I've ever heard about the restaurant business, when somebody asked him and said, do you want to go back to reinvest in a restaurant? Do you want to go back into the restaurant business? He said, well, if I had my choice between suicide and going back into the restaurant business, I'd need time to think.
So you got out of the restaurant business. You apparently had a little money left over because you hadn't been able to spend what you earned. And were you ready to go?
Well, I came back to Chapel Hill. I always had intentions of coming back here, and so I came back and to kind of bring things full circle back around. Richard, bless his heart, had lost to diabetes. He had lost his eyesight, and it was just.
But he was
about
still
gone.
In the business.
He was retiring. He was selling off everything and going out. And I came back
Tell
up here.
Tell us again the name of his business.
Was Poor Richards.
Poor Richards.
Poor Richards was the name of it. And, well, Richard was such a character. I mean, he, as a matter of fact, down at the store, you remember Jeff McNally that used to do the comic strip shoot? McNally, when he was here, was associated with Richard in the early 70s. And I've still got the original pen and ink down at the store that McNally did of Richard's logo.
Wow.
And anybody that's a historian or knows anything about past Chapel Hill will recognize that logo of Richard, little pot-bellied with a cigar hanging out of his mouth. And cigar ashes flowing
so
down.
Did he ever make it? Did that caricature ever make the comics?
I don't know if he ever. There's a lot of people that say that Richard was part of the composite of Shoe in the comic strip, but I don't have any authority to say one way or the other. But there's people that have speculated he was kind of the curmudgeon, part of the curmudgeon part of Richard. I know. To go back of an aside, when Richard, I mean, I know I went with him out to Los Angeles to see a doctor one time back in the late 70s, and he wanted to go out and spend some time at the Pritikin Longevity Center to get himself all fixed up, and so I went with him to California and like stayed with him out there, and we went to see this one specialist doctor, and Richard was notorious, as people that knew him will remember, he always had a cigar in his mouth, hanging out of his mouth, his little Have a Tampa cigars. It's like five to a pack, and you talk to the doctor into seeing him on a Saturday, And I was sitting out in the waiting room, and I could hear everything they were saying, like, going on, because there was no one else in the office. And it was like Sam was telegraphing out. And the doctor was chiding him about his blood sugar levels and this and smoking and this. And Richard was sitting in the doctor's office with a cigar in his mouth, if you can, like, go ahead.
But not lit. He was just chewing on it.
No, he had it lit.
He had it lit?
He had it lit. And the doctor was telling me, he said, now, how many of these, I mean, do you smoke a day? And Richard had a sort of a high-pitched, whiny type of, well, not whiny, but I mean a high-pitched voice. And he's going, I smoke about five a day. And the doctor just went livid. He said, you smoke five of these cigars a day? And Richard looked, I could hear him say, no, 5 packs of them a day.
So 25 a day, that would be the, oh my gosh.
And that's to give you an insight of what Richard was like. And so he was retiring, and this was 88 when I got back here. And I'd been just kind of fooling around for like 6 or 7 months, not really knowing what I was going to do. And in talking to Richard, he was retiring. He had put everything in a warehouse. And I said, well, Richard, look, I'll give you this. I mean, I love you to death. I would never come in and compete with you. I wouldn't come in and try to compete with you. But if you're going to retire and you're hanging it up, I'm going to pick up where you left off. And in his indomitable way, he sort of gave me his blessing, you know, and then going on and sold me his warehouse. Later on, I bought the warehouse. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Well, but so you're a legitimate successor to that business. I mean, not you bought.
Well, maybe
his stock.
Not legitimate. Richard would probably say illegitimate successor to it. But I mean,
you bought his stock, you bought his warehouse, and you didn't stay in the same location, I guess.
No. He was already out of a location. He just had everything stored.
And well, I'll tell you what. Let's take a break and then come back and talk about how you found the location for Surplus Sids. I'm talking to Barry Keith, owner of Surplus Sids, and at the really at the border of Chapel Hill and Carver. He and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin. My guest is Barry Keith. He's the owner of Surplus Sids in Carver, right near the border of Chapel Hill and Carver. But it's one of the first things, Barry, I see is I'm pedaling my bike or walking or riding, coming in from Chapel Hill, Carver. On the right, there's Surplus Sids. Looks like, you've got stuff to draw me in on the outside.
We have discovered.
How'd you pick that location?
When I opened up in 88, I was actually, there's a small building across the street.
Oh, really?
From
you were across the street
in 88, I started over there. And well, things, as I say, sort of get bigger than all of us. I mean, things started to expand, and what we had with that space was obviously going to be too small in no time. And the building that we are currently in now is directly across the street, and it came up for sale, and we closed the deal on it, and it was just moved, just took everything, moved across the street, and then just kept expanding from there. And you mentioned, like, riding by, and you see all the stuff outside going on. I discovered a long time ago that's probably the best advertising I've got, and I'm not putting down any other type of advertising, but I mean, it's just.
Well, now let's take a diversion just for a little bit, and I want to come back sort of to the chronological thing. But when you're talking, I'm intrigued when I go by your place and see stuff. It does make me want to come in. But you've had all kinds of things. I mean, spaceships and all. What are the memorable things that you put outside or on top of the roof to attract attention?
Well, we have rolled out, we've had a cannon out front.
Yeah,
that, of course, some people in Carborough were a little bit uneased by that. They didn't like the idea of a cannon pointing out across. Of course, I tried to explain to them. We said we were going to do like the noonday gun at Edinburgh Castle, you know, but the town of Carborough wouldn't let us fire it out across the parking lot. We've put
Was it a real cannon?
It was one we made for a production, ended up a doctor down in Chatham County bought it to put out in his front yard like a big dog. So it's not there anymore, but we sold that. We've had an Egyptian sarcophagus out front. That was always a cool piece. We always thought that was one that probably drew a lot of attention. We have built an awful lot of pieces of We invented kind of a nomenclature for the furniture we've got down there. We call it Frankenstein furniture.
Why?
Because it starts life as four or five pieces of something else. And we may turn a what was left of a chest of drawers that has no drawers into a rolling bar, or we'll take a table. One of the more unique pieces, there was a we call it our Da Vinci wings. It's all built out of broken chairs. It was just used in a presentation on campus this past weekend for a seminar that was held up there. But it looks like a Da Vinci ornithopter, more or less.
I don't know what that is.
It's a flying machine.
Oh, a flying machine. Okay.
Which I have to keep it up in the ceiling, up high and away, because my 11-year-old little girl, she's must be a little daredevil. She was telling me she was going to strap it on and get on the roof and see if she
could. See if it really worked.
Yeah, see if it glided.
Well, let's go back. And so you came to Carver in 1988. You bought the business of Poor Richard's surplus.
I just bought his warehouse, all of his supplies
his
he had left.
Yeah, and then established a new business in Carver. And what you knew from working for Poor Richard's something about from a few years back, something about what the surplus business had been back then. Now that you entered it again, was it just exactly the same as it was when you left it behind?
Well, it's the type of thing that's constantly evolving. It really is, and that's one of the beauties of it. But one of the things that caught my eye then, and most of the time in retail and normal retail, you have to more or less change with the season or change with styles and things like that. The thing about the military gear, and we've got probably 30 different nationalities worth of military clothing and gear in the store now, is it never goes out of style. I mean, it'll stay. A pea coat is going to be in style 50 years from now, as it was 50 years ago. And it's really, really high quality stuff. I mean, I'm not putting down anything made by other retailers or whatever. But if it's commercially made, they more or less put a built-in obsolescence in it. They want it to wear out, so you've eventually got to come back and buy another one. If it's made to a military specification, pretty much regardless of what nationality it's made for, it's conceivably made to last right on and on and on and on and on.
Well, now you mentioned earlier when you were working with Poor Richards,
right?
When you were a student, and you'd go out to these trade shows out in Las Vegas.
Right.
You go from place to place and place your orders. These would be mostly, I guess, American military surplus, but
not really. No. It was a lot of foreign surplus.
So you'd have dealers who specialized in the surplus of other nations.
Exactly.
And you'd have to make decisions. Back then, you'd have to make decisions, or you and Richard would make decisions about what you thought the Chapel Hill market would want. And what kinds of things could you be sure that if you bought them, you could sell them at a profit and all of them?
One thing that I remember that comes to mind, and even to this day, I wish I had 10,000 pair of them because I could sell every one of them. There was a pair of German moleskin pants from back in the 70s.
These were for one of the German military units?
German military.
Army?
The Wehrmacht or the whatever the West German military was at the time, and they were a grayish moleskin.
Bundeswehr.
Exactly. And they were a grayish, slick sort of material, and they were the Mac Daddy of a pair of knock-around pants or work pants or everything else, and they would sell as fast as you could get them in the door.
So you could buy them for $10 and sell them for $20, or is that the way it works, something like
that? Well, pretty much, you try to do, anything in retail, like classic retail, you try to do Keystone, but then oftentimes you have to cut way down on things just to make it move, depending upon condition. And then a lot of times in surplus, too, you have grades of things. You get something in that was, one of the things Richard taught me a long time ago, you never say used in the surplus business. It's just been previously appreciated, okay?
I had heard that before.
So it would
previously
come in.
Previously appreciated.
Exactly. So you might have something that had been worn by soldiers or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that would make it, there would be an enhanced value.
Sometimes a patina on it that makes it really, really attractive to certain people. They really, really like that. They dig that. They don't like the new or whatever. So you get the mixture of the new and the previously appreciated, as we call it. And what you see patterns. I mean, if you bring something in, and like anything, like in anything in retail, you can go out to a show or go to a dealer or somebody, get a phone call, and I'll get phone calls from all over the planet all week long. I mean, that's just—
What do you mean? From other dealers?
Other dealers, people that have—
Well, give me what was the one you got last? What was the call?
Let's see, 2 days ago, well, just shortly ago, I got a call from Prague, Czechoslovakia, or the Prague that had—
Czech Republic.
Czech Republic that had these really great leather— it's actually a Soviet design, Soviet era design map case.
Uh-huh.
And I ordered up some of those because they sell like hotcakes.
He called you to say, I've got these, don't you want them?
Exactly.
And you trusted him.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
I've done business with him for 20 years, so yeah.
And so he sells you 10 or 15 or 100 or—
Well, usually you try to buy— usually the Europeans like to do things in tens as opposed to America. We like to do things in 12s.
Right.
And so you'll buy, you know, maybe 40 or 50 of them at a time, and because that
now,
cuts
do
your shipping
you
down.
You can sell those, or are you going to bring them and then you're going to become a little sub-dealer with some of your buddies here?
Well,
if
somebody wants to buy multiples, I've done large— I mean, if I've gotten a mass quantity of something in and somebody comes and wants masses of them, yeah, I've done that before. But usually it's individual sales is what we
do. So he calls you and— The language of your conversations in English, I guess.
Of course, yeah.
And so he says, this is something I think, based on what you bought from me before, I think this is something your people will like. Why? But I'm kind of thinking, a map case? What does anybody around here want a map case for?
Well, if you ever came down there, I could show you one. The thing is, like, you know, it's one of those perfect sizes that one can slide a HP, like a laptop into. And then there's a little compartments and things around it, and people dig that sort of thing because you open it up, you've got all sorts of it, and it's be the equivalent of you know, a lady's handbag or a man purse, like a guy would, but it's kind of a masculine looking bag. I know walking around, going into the metro in Moscow several times, I saw several Russian officers, like high ranking Russian officers, like a polkovnik, a colonel, or a young lieutenant colonel, all very dashingly dressed, but he always had that map case over his shoulder, that strapped down is like his sort of briefcase, and it's not quite as big as a briefcase, but it's one of those things. And people, we hang them up front, and people dig them; they like them, and it's a great piece, and it lasts a long, long time. And then there's always some little aside story about a piece of surplus that comes in. And the one that was related to me about that one is the case itself is a synthetic dye or done to pretty much is the way it would be manufactured. But the strap, the hanging strap that hangs off of it, is done with a natural vegetable dye. And the reason for that is Russian military doctrine all the way back to the Soviet times and the like. They had, and their field belts are done the same way. It was done with a natural dye. So if you're in the field and you run out of rations, you run out of food, you can boil the strap or boil the belt and make soup. And that's a true story.
We're visiting with Barry Keith. We're talking about his business at Surplus Sids, and he and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Barry Keith. He's the owner of Surplus Sids. We're talking about the military surplus business, Barry, and for one reason or another, it's just fascinating. I don't know whether it's just because I was in the Army and I like all that stuff. I like to go touch it. I like it. When I was growing up, the surplus business, it was all – I mean, it was even a lot of World War II stuff and then finally a little bit of Korean War stuff that was coming in. It was real American dirtied up stuff that people were getting rid of, and it was real cheap. It's different now, isn't it? I mean, it's different.
It's definitely, from the time I started years ago or when I was taught the business years ago to now, it's definitely gone through an evolution. I mean, it's become quite a bit different because so many other things have entered the surplus market. I mean, people ask me – I get asked 10, 15 – maybe not 10, 15. It seems like 10 times a week. Where does your stuff come from?
Yeah. I should have just asked you that question. Where does your stuff come from?
Well, the real answer is so long and convoluted, we just kind of got to the point of being flip about it. Somebody would say, well, where does your stuff come from? I'd say, well, we steal most of it, but, I mean, it's going – and then we get these strange looks out of people, and we stop and say, well, no, it comes from, you know, 30 or 40 different nationalities worth of government, military.
For anybody who is late, here's the stuff that, you know, I've learned that I didn't know, and that is, first of all, there's a lot of international military stuff from armies all over the world that makes just walking through your store an interesting experience. And the question that I had is, where do you get that stuff? And you have told us that you that multiple sources all over, some at trade shows where you can sign up for it, and some that you have a network of friends across the world who will, when they see stuff that they think you might want, they're in the business of selling it in bulk, and they'll call you and sell you a little bit of it.
Well, exactly. I mean, and I'd like to think, basically the risk of braggadocio, they know my face at the Portobello flea market in outside of London, and then the Izmailova flea market in Moscow. I'm notorious for going to find something
there. Now, this is, you hadn't told me this before, but you're also traveling. You're traveling to...
not as much as I'd like, but yes, some.
But markets, not just trade shows, but markets themselves where there's a retail business and you can go and buy special things. What kind of things would you buy at the London flea market or the Moscow flea market?
Well, it's been a number of years since I've been into the Portobello Road flea market. But if you go and get out there early enough on a weekend morning, as they say, you get in the queue to get in, you can go in. And the British government, I'm not putting the British down on this, but they were notorious about all of their surplus. They wanted to destroy it or damage it somehow before they put it out. But if you go in over there, you can get your hands. I've got several really, really nice scarlet tunics, as they say, or what most people would refer to as the British red coats,
uh-huh.
Yes, which are just absolutely gorgeous when you look at them.
So I've noticed them in your or something like that in your
right.
store, and they're priced pretty high. Or is it because you don't really want to sell them?
Well, I try not to get emotionally attached to anything down there, but part with it. But you know, you want to get a fair value for what you've got in it. And then some have got a couple of antique. I've got one or two of the original bearskin hats, like the household guards that guard Buckingham Palace, that sort of thing.
Now those, I mean, but that puts you in a real situation of conflict because you're started out as a collector. You told us earlier of hats, so you got these great hats. You got to put them on. You've got to say, I've got to make some money. I can't just collect this stuff. But at the same time, when you price it, and you sort of say, I just hope nobody buys that today.
I find something, now this is what I'm guilty of. Of course, Richard taught me a long time ago. You made a say, he said, never fall in love with the goods, okay? But being a hat collector, often if I find like a unique piece like that, I'll try to get more than one. And that way I have one to sell and at least one to sell and at least one to put away. And it's nice to have – if I find a hat that's got some provenance with it or something like that, like it belonged to a particularly, you know, semi-famous person or something of that nature, I'll put it – if you've ever noticed the big glass case I've got in the corner there in the store, that's where that goes in. And
so that is for display primarily, but if somebody really wanted it, they could probably give you a price that you –
Oh, I'm not cheap, but I can be had, yes. I mean, it's
Well, one of the things that I want to talk about I want you to talk about is that tell us, first of all, how did the Army surplus business morph into supplier of costumes for events in Chapel Hill and other places and for dramatic productions in all over?
Well, the other part, the costume part of the store that we've got actually evolved from one of the underlying parts of surplus is what they like to call closeouts,
mm-hmm.
where businesses are going out of business or some particular enterprise, say a theater company or a Savile Yard company or something like that, is closing down. I mean, that's and they have to dispose of what they have. And so if you have a connection in that network, you can pick up bits and pieces of that. And then supplement it, there are companies that sell costumes and whatever. And so if you've got these original kind of a base of what you've got coming from these closeouts, you can add to that. And the whole costume section, I don't know, it just kind of took on a life of its own.
When did
in the
you,
back.
Did the first year you were in business, did people come by at Halloween time?
I'll remember the very first Halloween we had when we were across the street over in 88, mm-hmm. and we had one of the best days we've ever had to get started in business. And everything from that, we just started adding pieces. And
so when the first – excuse me for interrupting you, but the first time you noticed this, the first year you were in business, people mm-hmm. came in because they were – using the military stuff primarily as for costumes.
Well, that or trying to be. One of the things I noticed about Chapel Hill is with Halloween, especially Halloween is like the one totally self-indulgent holiday where everybody wants to be a little bit creative on their own and come up with some idea that's really their own. And they draw a lot of inspiration from certain things that I have in the store. Like, I have this piece I can turn into this, or I can make this work as this other part of the theme for the costume that I'm making. So we kept adding on to that and adding on to that and adding on to that. And then we would get people in the theater and film business.
Let's take a break, okay. And then we'll move into visiting with Barry Keith. We're talking about his business, Surplus Sids, and we just started talking about the costuming feature of that. We'll continue that discussion after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking? This is D.G. Martin. I'm learning about Surplus Sids, the business in Carrboro, surplus business, and I'm talking to the business owner, Barry Keith. Barry, we just moved from the regular surplus business into the part of your business that do you call it the costuming division now? What do you?
Well, I'd often thought that what we would do with the costumes, we take and separate them out and do a separate business and call it Uncle Sid's Attic, but that's never come to fruition. But the costumes get to be a lot of fun because we developed. A lot of people, we've got such an artistic theatrical community in the area. And people started coming in from theater and film work and things like that. And they'd be looking for something unusual and odd. And we developed a reputation as kind of a go-to sort of individual. If you needed it, we could come up with it, whether it be a prop or whether it be...
More than just going in and wandering around seeing if you saw something, they would come to you and say, this is what we need. Can you help us find it?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, a good example I can think of is a film being shot down in Wilmington, and the studios down there called up, and they said they had looked all over the 48 contiguous states trying to find this particular item that they needed for these several scenes that they had.
Can you tell us what the item was?
Actually, it's parts to a helicopter is what they were looking for. Right? Yeah, and they seats of all things. And... I took the phone. I said, "Well, give me a number, and I'll call you back." I called two sources that I had in 15 minutes. I called them back and had exactly what they wanted, and they had claimed they'd looked all over the country and couldn't find it. So after that, I kind of got a reputation as a miracle worker with them, and that kind of spread among the certain people down there. And I get calls from different productions all the time.
Now the payoff for that, because there would be a lot of work, a lot of conversation and tracking down, but that there wouldn't be much price resistance for what you're selling. That is that you can get a fair markup from what you pay and what you sell it.
Well, you know, you can't give it away, but you try to cover yourself. Exactly. Yes.
Well, what I'm thinking is this just for fun, or can you make money off of this?
Oh, sure, you can make some money off of it.
You can make a lot of money when you're able to provide something that somebody can't find, and you provide it. There's less price resistance than when it's a genuine commodity.
Well, it's kind of an aha moment. I think the thrill is being able just to. I mean, you remember how Scotty on Star Trek used to always love himself as a miracle worker? You know, that's...
So now let's talk about this for a minute. So you get more pleasure out of getting the helicopter part than you do for somebody who will be your friend and maybe a future customer. You get more pleasure out of just doing it than you do of making a superior profit off of the sale of that item.
Well, is it too egotistical to say I like to think that all roads lead to SIDS? I mean, that's...
No. That's but only if when they get there that you've got things that you can sell at a price that gives you ability to put food on the table.
Well, true. And then there's a lot of spare parts. I know Gary, my helper down there, Gary gets upset with me for a lot of the spare parts that I keep around. But the fact of the matter is, like I explained to him, I'm going to have to make something out of that because, well, for instance, we had a high school production that came in just a short time ago that's doing a 1930s sort of play, and they needed a 1930s-looking microphone. and out of spare parts that we had collected from other pieces of surplus that we had bought or saved or whatever, and we had put the thing together, and it looked exactly like a 1930s microphone, and that's exactly what they needed. So it's a culmination of things that oftentimes becomes kind of a satisfying
something,
thing.
In this case, this is something that arguably had no value until somebody came along for whom it did have value, and then you could get a fair price for it, and they could be very happy that they got what they needed.
Well, in the recycling vein, we always like to think we can repurpose something in a much more productive way.
Well, what about getting back to the regular costuming business? Big segment of the business would be for college students and others at these holiday times, Mardi Gras, Halloween, where you dress up. How do you make money? You rent some of it, you sell some of it. How do you make a fair return?
Well, as the costumes go, generally it's rental, unless somebody is going to take it out of town and they'll very plainly take. Well, no, or it's a theater production where they say we're going to have to destroy it as part of the production. Whether that's usually more in film work than it is in theater, and if that's the case, of course they're going to buy it, they're going to keep it themselves, but oftentimes we'll just rent it to them. And how we work the rental is we, you know, take in a security deposit on the rental, and then when it's returned, they get the security deposit back. But then the rental comes out of it is a portion of what the value of it is. And that
– what would be my rough and ready is that the rental is a pretty high percentage of what the value is, maybe 40 or 50%, so that a one-time use is double or triple that, and you could buy it. Why is that?
You have to take into the consideration the manpower of taking it in, then it coming back, and of course it's got to be cleaned when it comes back, and other, and there's expenditures involved in that, and so even using something over and over again, and then, I suppose with renting anything, you just kind of set the course of figuring how long something is going to last. And let's say you're probably going to be able to rent it, you know, five to six times before it's defunct, and then it's a devaluation that goes into it. So oftentimes you'll end up with something that goes on a discount rack because it's reached its life expectancy.
What are the popular items from last Halloween or Mardi Gras? What are people who want to dress up? What are the things they like to dress up as these days?
DJ, it goes completely across the board. I never even try to narrow it down. It goes from astronauts to Zulu warriors. I mean, it is anything and everything. And if they come in, we'll try to put it together for them. I know I get a lot of not just college kids coming in doing things, but like a lot of the elementary schools will do what they call a wax museum. And the young kids have to pick a character, a historical character, and then they have to emulate that character. And I know I had one little fella come in, third grader, not too long ago, and he wanted to be a Civil War sailor. I can't recall the character's name. I'm sorry, it escapes me. But a cute little guy, and I mean, he was focused on what he wanted to do. And we had came up, went over to the hat section, found him the perfect hat that he wanted, and showed him how to do his jacket that looked almost like a pea coat, and he was ready to go, and he was going to do really, really well with that.
You have fun with that part of the business.
Well, I got a degree from UNC in history, and I've always loved history. And anytime, you know, young ones or little ones come in the store and they're interested in history or willing to do something like that, and I can help them some way, you know, to get a greater grasp on that historical part of what they're trying to do, That gives me a thrill. It really does.
Well, one of the other things I think you're excited about is being in Carrboro, and things are happening down there in your area. You're in the middle of urban redevelopment.
You know, Carrboro's growing. There's no doubt about that, at least I think, hopefully in a good way.
You're going to be here for a while?
Unless they carry me out of their feet first, yeah, I plan on it.
Thanks to Barry Keith for visiting with us and telling us a little bit about his business, Surplus SIDS. And the challenge of doing business, any kind of business these days, and the excitement of being in Carrboro. Barry, thanks.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, who's talking. I'll be back here before you know it.